Did anyone here lose anyone close to them in the fire?
Yeah.
So, talk a little bit about grief. And I also knew someone, not closely, but a very sweet young man named Johnny, who I met several years ago at a party in an Oakland warehouse that was, you know, unregulated, illegal, upstairs. And a beautiful guy. And a lot of the people who died in the fire were artists, queer youth, folks, like all of us, but in a very particular way, doing the best they can to find joy in a very challenging world. And part of a very tight-knit community in many cases. So, in the Buddhist tradition, there's so much talk about non-attachment and letting go and impermanence. And there's the sense that to be attached to anything is productive of suffering, right? Brings pain. Right? The wisdom teachings say, recognize that everything that has the conditions to come into being also automatically, always, has the conditions to leave being, or that the form of being that it's come into. Everything that has the conditions to be born has the conditions to pass away. And that this is true about everything that we encounter. People, things, places, ideas, nations, our own bodies, our own sense of self even, have the conditions to come into form, to assemble out of everything into a recognizable or solid form for some time and then dissolves. Both the Hindu and Buddhist traditions recognize this. The Hindu tradition frames it in a beautiful way in relation to three deities, where there's a force that creates things, the deity Brahma, and a force that sustains things for some amount of time, the deity Vishnu, and a force that dissolves things or destroys things, Shiva. And these are considered to be three aspects of the universe that we could call divine or ultimate qualities. And the Buddhist system speaks about it very precisely in relation to the teachings on karma or action, that all actions have results. One of the challenges in the teaching on karma is that while all actions have results, things that happen can't be said to be the direct or singular result of any one thing. That the conditions at play in any moment's experience are vast. So, you know, I'm getting over a cold because my baby brought home a cold, or I'm getting over a cold because, you know, the human race has evolved into a symbiotic relationship with this, you know, virus. Or, and we could make that or, you know, a broad list of things. Because my house is cold, because California houses don't have insulation, because I can't afford insulation. Like, any thread you pull on shakes the whole blanket, said. So we're grieving young people lost in a fire. And the karma of the fire is complex, right? The karma of the fire has embedded in it the actions of the artists that made the space and the economic conditions that make such spaces only possible on the fringes of mainstream society, that make it impossible actually to create safe artist space that's affordable in these cities. It has the karma of, in a sense, the relationship of young people to a dominant culture. And it has the karma of the oppression of queer youth, of non-gender-conforming youth, of non-mainstream-conforming youth. So there's these teachings on impermanence and non-attachment. The second noble truth says grasping or attachment is the cause of suffering. Letting go of that grasping brings relief from that suffering. But so often people ask, well, what about love for people? What about just loving people? Is that attachment? Am I supposed to not be attached to the people that I love? The teaching doesn't say that. It says, yes, the people we love will be separated from us. No matter how close we get to be with someone or how stable the relationship, it will go. One of the most poignant, kind of heart-rending experiences I have of being married and hoping that I'll be married to this person for the rest of my life is to know that one of us will die first and not knowing which would be better. So there's a beautiful story from the sutra in the early Buddhist texts, the long text that describes the final days of the Buddha. It's called the Parinibbana Sutta. And it describes the Buddha contracting a kind of food poisoning from a meal given by a donor, and knowing that he was weakening and about to die, he sets out walking toward his home, toward the village he was born in, the town he was born in. And even that has a kind of heartfelt quality to me. Like, he's fully liberated from all attachment and suffering. Why does he walk toward home in his last moments? But he does. He doesn't make it. He makes it about halfway into a place that is kind of a small town, not an important place. And he settles in there. It says, between two sala trees, two noble trees, and lays down on his right side. And his monks, his attendants, say, you know, Blessed One, don't die here. In this, the translation says, in this miserable place in the back of beyond. It's like, oh no, like at least like make it to Varanasi, make it to one of the great cities, you know, to die. And the Buddha says, no, you don't understand. Yeah, this is a great place to go. And all this stuff happens as the Buddha's about to die, including one last convert. A young man comes running up, kind of confused, and says, oh, all of this, like, people are grieving, there's all this formal stuff going on, and this young guy comes running up and says, wait, I'm suffering, I want to join the order. And the monks are like, go away. And the Buddha's like, no, bring him in. He gives him a very simple, basic teaching, like he's given thousands of times in his 45 years of teaching, and then they ordain him a monk. He's the last directly ordained disciple of the Buddha. And as the Buddha is lying on his deathbed, there's a short conversation that the text records between two of his most beloved disciples. His cousin, Ananda, who has been with him as his attendant for decades, and who has memorized every discourse the Buddha ever gave. And after the Buddha dies, he will recite the entire teachings of the Buddha to the gathering of monastics in order to preserve them. He's very, very beloved. And he has this quality in the texts of being very sweet. People fall in love with him and kind of follow him around. And he's super nice. He's the one that when they need someone to go and be really nice to someone, they send Ananda. He has this kind of innocent, sweet quality in many of the stories. He's probably the most beloved of the disciples. And then a second disciple named Sariputta, who is known as the foremost in wisdom. And he's really crisp. And whenever they need someone to explain a complicated point of doctrine, they send Sariputta, right? And they're friends. They've been friends for, 30, 40 years, something. And the text says Sariputta comes to the hut where the Buddha had been living or resting there, and that he sees Ananda standing in the doorframe, leaning on the doorframe, weeping. Sariputta says, "Friend Ananda, why do you weep?" This is, Sariputta. He's sort of the Spock of the texts, right? He's crisp. He's very, very detailed. He says, "Friend Ananda, why do you weep?" And Ananda, who's also not fully enlightened at this point, right? Which I think is mythologically beautiful. Like, he still is a little bit caught up, right, in the world in this beautiful way. He says, "The Blessed One is leaving the world. Our light is leaving the world. My teacher, my guide is leaving the world." And Sariputta says to Ananda, "Haven't you been paying attention to the teachings?" Which is sort of funny, right? He's memorized 45 years worth of teachings. And Sariputta's like, "Haven't you been paying attention? Impermanence, right?" And it's this, I think it's a beautiful exchange, partly because the text doesn't actually imply that there's anything wrong with what Ananda's doing. The text doesn't take Sariputta's side and say, "Oh, Ananda, that fool, he's grieving, he should be unattached." I think it's beautiful, actually, that these two men, who are old men at this point, are shown, in a way, manifesting kind of two sides of the teaching. Ananda is manifesting the heart quality of just pure grief. He's weeping for his teacher. His cousin also, his family member, who he loves dearly. And then Sariputta is seeing through it all to the clarity of kind of cooled out liberation. And in the final moments of this teacher, the text offers us these two pictures of how we might respond to the loss of someone we love and value. I think it's important to value Ananda's grief and to value our own grief. The teachings on attachment say essentially that either a sense pleasure or something that gives us something, a sense of meaning that we hook onto, we start to build a sense of self around. I love this person, I married this person. If they left, I would be so broken. Which can be true. And the text simply points out in a way that if we take that further into a solidified or clenched or contracted sense of self. Like, if I lose this person, I will be nothing. My life will have no more meaning. Then it reminds us, I think accurately, that there will be more suffering there. That in a way, to hold on to that degree, to identify with the thing we're connected with to that degree, is in some way to be in denial of reality, the reality of birth and death. At the same time, it doesn't say we should never love anything. In fact, the teachings on attachment are balanced by the teachings on loving kindness, compassion, joy, equanimity, the balanced heart that is engaged with the world, compassionate, responding to suffering, kind, friendly, loving. So these two portraits, Ananda's sweet grief and Sariputta's clear wisdom, hold each other. And I almost imagine Sariputta knowing that it's right, that like one of them sees through to the clarity of birth and death, and the other, in a sense, feels them fully, in an embodied way, leans against the doorframe and weeps. So I'll add another piece here. The word that we translate as mindfulness, the word sati, it means literally memory, to remember. And probably in the early texts, it referred not so much to a wide-open quality of non-judgmental awareness, which is often how it's described now. That description probably has quite a bit of Zen influence in it. Originally, it seems to have meant something a little closer to what we could call like recollection, like remembering the qualities of the Buddha. And that would be like reminding yourself, and there's lists to remind yourself, the Buddha is a blessed one, fully awakened, teacher of gods and humans, etc., etc. Or remembering or recollecting the body, right? Remembering the body. And memory, then, is an interesting translation in relation to attachment. That to remember something or to think back on it is a way of being mindful of it. One of the things that grief does is it brings our mind into the past. We remember people. I remember this young man, Johnny, his face, his smile, the way that he lounged with his partner on some cushions at the edge of a party. And so that actually to remember something or someone is to be mindful of it. And then our practice of mindfulness, in a way, is to notice, to remember, to honor, to value, without clinging, everything. Passing feelings of remorse, passing feelings of anger, of fear. The sense of the body as it is just now, already different than it was 5 minutes ago. Right. We're already older and in some strange way closer to our death than we were when we started sitting tonight. So then our practice, in a way, is to balance these two qualities of our heartfelt engagement with the world and the quality of an observing, clear-minded wisdom that knows this is how things are, this is the unfolding of karma, this is impermanence in action. And to be mindful or to recollect the qualities that we come across as we practice. I think it's not random that the Buddhists are behind the hospice movement. And a lot of Buddhists become chaplains. And there's some way that these teachings invite us to change our relationship with death and loss in a way that's wholesome, in a way that's right and good. This is a religion with no judge at its heart, no damnation. It's also a religion that understands that the force that animates bodies moves through bodies into other bodies. Maybe literally in the way that the universe willing, my son will outlive me and perhaps have a child of his own, and onward goes the energy of life out of this body into another body. How does that work? Right. Or even just any action we do opens into the future. We give our life energy to something and it goes forward, it goes out of us into others. You do something to serve your community and it ripples out from you, and soon that energy that was in you, maybe as the energy of caring or loving or kindness, moves through you, through words, through action, and soon it's out there in the world and it's beyond your control. You've become reborn as an idea you had gets planted, or something you started goes on without you. So a religion that understands that nothing ends, at the same time as it understands that everything particular ends and changes into something else. That there's no judge and no finality, becomes a place where folks can meet directly the reality of life and death, birth and death. So there's a sweet place in this tradition for grieving, making rituals for those we've lost, celebrating those we've lost, and letting go. Teaching on non-attachment is still the heart of the doctrine, that we are always encouraged to notice the places where circumstances have a hook in us, where we lose our center just slightly, clinging to this relationship, this place, this sensation, clinging to health or youth or privilege or position. And it's this beautiful weave. The last thing I'll say about these two sides, the love and appreciate and feel side, and the see clearly and liberate and let go side. There's a little bit something, a paraphrase of one of my teachers, Anam Tupten, who teaches up in Richmond, who said also, he's giving a long talk on love and emptiness, which is essentially this same dyad, and said, oh, by the way, the emptiness side, the deep letting go, like seeing clearly side, has been the favorite of the two sides of men in power in this religion for a very long time. The patriarchs prefer the wisdom side to the love side. And he said, with a little smile, he said, and they've been in power long enough. Let's lean in the direction of loving things. We need more of that than we need, you know, the sword of detachment right now, with the world as it is right now. They're inextricable. Love without wisdom becomes attachment and constriction, clinging, bondage. Wisdom without love becomes cold and distant. Neither is liberated without the other. So there's a little quote I'll end with. I can't remember who said it, and I'm not going to say it correctly. So there you go. A misquoted, unattributed phrase. But if you know either the correct one, the correct phrasing, or the attribution, you can be my footnote and say so. Oh, the emptiness that haunts our days is their very fragrance. Oh, the emptiness that haunts our days is their very fragrance. Something like that. That this truth of loss and the dissolving of things, constant change, how it all slips through our fingers like air, that itself is the thing that makes the living poignant and beautiful. That is actually the beautiful in things. Right? One of the things that's beautiful about a rose in full bloom is the knowledge of its decay. Because if it was always like that, you wouldn't notice it. So, blessings to those who've passed. May they be liberated. Blessings to all those living, grieving. May they find comfort. May we all. So let's just sit for a moment. Thanks for listening. It's a pleasure to be here. A challenging week. Maybe they all are. For our last part of being together, just some space to hear from you, to hear some other voices, any reflections. If you want to tell us about anyone you love, or any questions, of course, about practice.
Mm-hmm. I was just wondering, so what is love with wisdom then?
It's a good question. Mm-hmm. What does anyone think? What is love with wisdom for you?
Blissful.
Blissful? Yeah, right? Mm-hmm. How do you know when wisdom's there? Feel it, yeah, it's truthful.
I think when you still feel like you as well, I think that's an important part of it.
You still feel like you, like you're not lost in.
Right, you haven't given something over to the extent that you're not yourself anymore.
Yeah, that's nice. Yeah, I think there's some way that it's almost like, what's love like when I'm not confused?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Even though that kind of confused love feeling is so kind of great for a little while, but there's a kind of maybe a maturity to it. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure.
Right.
Yeah, when you haven't lost yourself. How do you love something knowing that you'll lose it, without resisting losing it, but while still holding on. The right kind of holding on.
Returning to loving yourself in order to more, to have that love, wisdom.
I like this. Right, there's some way that like this blissfulness, when love is really clear, it's almost like I can feel when that disappears and grasping takes its place. And it's subtle, right? Because I'm delighting in something and then suddenly I'm just a little and I might like, oh, look, I leaned off too far off my center, or I just fell, or I did whatever I did, I lost myself. And the thing I want to notice is that little clench. Like, oh, I got lost for a moment. I got confused in a way. So that almost like the very... like the grasping itself is the sign to come back to myself. You know, in the way that like when you notice the mind wandering, you come back. You can't come back before you noticed it. Right? One of the funny things about the instruction, when you notice the mind wandering, come back, is that if you've noticed it wandering, you're already back. And you can't notice it until you notice it. And then it gets very interesting because, of course, how do you practice coming back from distraction? It's almost like saying, okay, we're going to practice waking up after we've been asleep, as if you could, right? You just wake up when you wake up. And you can put an alarm on, and you could do the same thing here. You could say, I'm going to put an alarm on for 2 minutes, and then if when the alarm goes off, my mind was wandering, right? Then I know it was wandering. I used to play this game when I was sitting on retreat. 45 minutes of sitting, mind would wander, it would come back, sometimes very focused, sometimes very distracted. But every time the bell would ring to end the sitting, I would try to notice whether I was really present in the moment the bell rang or whether the bell brought me back from distraction. And then I went too far and shamed myself whenever I was distracted, so that didn't work so well. But yeah, how do you practice without an alarm, without an external alarm? How do you learn, actually, how to just notice the shift from a kind of blissful centeredness to that clench of contraction? I think you just start by noticing it. Like, oh, look, got contracted. Oh, look. You have to feel it. This is what contraction feels like. This is what grasping feels like. And then I emphasize it a lot because it's hard to notice. This is what non-grasping feels like. This is what ease feels like. One of the biggest mistakes we make is we think that when we're centered, not grasping, balanced, open-hearted, kind, present, mindful, that... we have arrived at how things should be, and everything else is a mistake. It's like, ah, now things are correct, and the other part is incorrect. Right? And that's what we would call wrong view. That's a misinterpretation of how it works. Right? It's a natural system, how it works, and it just oscillates. The heart opens, the heart closes, the mind wanders, the mind comes back. If you're not doing it, how could one of them be right and one of them be wrong? That's just judgment. One of the best things we can do is take the judging out of the practice and just be like, oh, look, the mind's back. It's lovely, pleasurable, right? Oh, look, I got attached. Amazing. So common. Oh, look, I let go. Wow. One of my teachers said, after, you know, 40 years of practice, very respected teacher, he said, you know, I never let anything go. Like, never in my life have I let something go. And what he means is you can't let go on purpose. You can't just decide to no longer be trapped by something. It goes on its own when you see clearly. So all you can do is pay attention, right? And you do the best actions you can. And things let go when they let go. That one's a challenging one. We very often give the instruction, just let go, just let go. But I think what we mean is relax and see clearly. Relax and be open to seeing how things actually are. And that when we see how things actually are, then we let go. Something like that. Other thoughts, feelings here?
I appreciate the conversation on letting go. It's something I don't think I do so easily. I'm probably not alone.
You're the only one, right. I'm sure. Yeah.
And yet, like, there's times when I realize in retrospect how I really, really probably should have let go, like, long ago, and yet I haven't, or I don't know when. You said about, it's not exactly like you choose it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because in a way I've been like, oh, well, when should I let go? Like, it is this conscious choice.
Mm-hmm.
But you're saying you don't think it's actually exactly that way.
I don't think it's exactly that way. I think the conscious choice is that we can choose. I think this is what we do in meditation. We choose where to put our attention. Mm-hmm. I choose to pay attention to this thing or that thing. So then maybe I say, like, oh, I'm trying to heal from a challenging breakup. I'm going to put my attention on, you know, my job or my body or my health or my friends or something. And I think what we mean in doing that is that whenever I notice that my attention has gone back kind of to the past or to regret or to chewing on that thing, I want to become mindful of that and come back to the present or redirect my attention. Or I want to do things to bring myself out of, say, a certain kind of repetitive gnawing, chewing the cud of it, and do something kind of intentional around, I'm going to do a ritual, you know, I'm going to burn something, you know. So doing the ritual, you know, is what we can do. And maybe it results in we change our state. Maybe our state changes from kind of contracted to more open. And in that state change, letting go is more possible. Mm. I think that we do the actions we can do, and then letting go, in a way, is the possible result of that if our actions have been successful. If the conditions are right, we would say, for letting go to happen. I think about letting go mostly as a developmental process. Mm. The way that, like, I didn't decide to stop being fixated on Japanese cartoons about transformable robots. They're great, let me tell you. But you know, there was a few years there, in the mid-80s, where, you know, they were the bee's knees, and I had posters all over my wall of large transforming robots. And I collected videotapes, and and it was the thing. And I never said to myself, like, all right, son, time to grow up and start, you know, getting obsessed with something else. Like, you know, I don't know, memorize the lineage of the English kings rather than, you know, whatever. That was the next thing I went on to. But, slightly obsessive. So, hey. But it just ended, you know. And like, past relationships that I've grieved, I never said, okay, be done with it now. it was, I just went on having friendships and doing things and you know, remembering and torturing myself and stopping torturing myself and just sort of doing my life. And then at some point I was like, oh, look, you know, it has settled in me. Like the angst has turned into real grief. And that's for me a marker of actual letting go, is like, you know, oh, there's a kind of clenched heart that turns into the appropriate grieving of something, and then that turns into a kind of, you know, more equanimous memory. Like, oh, that happened. That's real, you know. So, yeah. Some thoughts on that. So the thing about like, oh, I should have let go, comes, right?
Yeah.
And mostly in line with this particular interpretation of letting go, when I say that, and of course I've said that too to myself, like, oh, I should have let go of that thing long ago. What I want to do in that moment is pause and say, okay, that's a judgment. What am I feeling that's giving rise to that? And it's like, oh, I'm feeling that it's still here, like I'm still attached in some way. And so then what I want to do is just feel that and be like, oh, something's incomplete. Just that. And I don't need to... Who's to say what should have been done? If it's still here, it's still here. Like, and especially if we go in the direction of it's not volitional, then there's no should, right? Mm-hmm. Unless we say like, oh, I should have done a grieving ritual a year ago. It's like, well, but I didn't. You know, again, there's no judge in this system, mm-hmm. other than our own, you know, fictional one. So I just want to see, like, oh, what's still here that wants attention, that wants care? And then give it that care, and then see what happens. Yeah. Make sense? Yeah.
Thoughts? Can you talk a little bit more about how to eliminate judgment? Like, what are your strategies for
patience. Yeah. Yeah. It's a whole practice topic unto itself. One of the most interesting things we can start to notice about repetitive thought is how connected it is to other people and to the culture around us. So, you know, my one-year-old baby is a little chubby, as one-year-old babies are often. And he has no concept of his chubbiness, right? As far as I can tell, doesn't seem to. But at some point, our culture will teach him that chubbiness has a meaning, and that he should carry that meaning in his body and in his walk and in his gaze and in his suffering. That he should suffer over chubbiness. Whether he ends up having it or not as a thing. So one of the first things I want to recognize, this is on the wisdom side of the equation, is that our repetitive thoughts almost entirely, and I'm only saying almost to be, you know, to soften the blow, but really thoughts are given to us by our culture. The language itself comes from the culture. The words we use to talk to ourselves were taught to us by other people. Mostly the phrases we say to ourselves we heard somewhere. right? We're in a culture that thinks that chubbiness means one thing. And if we were in a different culture, it would mean something else. And so all of the thoughts we have that are self-judging and other judging, for that matter, we didn't come up with them, you know. My baby doesn't know the difference between white people and brown people, right? But he'll learn. He'll learn because of history, right? Because we live in conditions that are soaked through with suffering from the past, right? He'll learn to be oppressed or to be an oppressor, or both. So when the judging thought comes, one of the things we can do is not think it's me. It's to be like, oh, look, that. You know, and you can make some categories of them, you know, that can help. They can be like, you know, negative thoughts about my body, right? You can just put all of that into, you know, bad things patriarchy taught me. You know, negative thoughts about my intelligence, ditto, right? Negative thoughts about my relationship skills. You know, and you just go down the list and be like, oh, this came from somewhere, you know. I have a repetitive thought called I'm an insensitive dude who doesn't have feelings and I should become a more sensitive New Age guy. And that thought essentially is conditioned by the collision of my having grown up with a stoic, non-emotionally expressive Catholic dad and landing in hyper-emotionally expressive New Age San Francisco and Berkeley, right, where a different masculinity is asked of me by my partners and friends. Did I come up with that? It's like, that's so much bigger than me, and all of them are. So the main thing, I think, is to disidentify, to not think that it's me. That's step one, but actually it's step two, because step one is to notice them. You can't even do that until you stop when it's happening and be like, oh, there it is again. It's that thought. In the Buddhist tradition, the judge or those kinds of thoughts is given a persona. It's a demon, essentially, bless you, called Mara, who is descended from a version of the god of death. It essentially says that, like, doubtful thoughts, judging thoughts, are a form of death. Right? And what they could, because they kind of, they kill our spirit. And there's this being who's considered to be a kind of semi-divine being called Mara, who comes to visit the Buddha a lot, including after he's enlightened, by the way, many, many times through his life, when the Buddha is self-judging. There's a time when the Buddha, who after a while had a bad back, his back was hurting, he didn't want to give the Dharma talk that night, so he asked Ananda to give the talk for him. He went back to his hut and laid down to rest. And Mara showed up and said, ooh, blessed one, the one who is equanimous, the one who is above suffering, has a hurting back. Are you afraid of pain, blessed one? Why are you shirking your job? Right? Doubtful thoughts, right? Self-judging thoughts, we could say, even after he's enlightened. And the Buddha says, I see you, Mara. So the main thing to do is see this creature and not think that it's you again. So first you have to first notice the thoughts. And you can name your judge if you want. Many people do. It's very nice. Give the judge a ridiculous name. It helps. You know, Beauregard or something. Which is not ridiculous. I'm just suggesting, you know. But, you know, Shirley. You know, whatever. It's hard to say names. You know, Beauregard and Shirley are both fine people. Undoubtedly. So you notice them, and then you don't identify with them. Maybe the third last thing I'll say for now is that you feel their pain. So the only way we stop doing something, this is basically an addiction model, we stop doing something only when we notice that it hurts. If we don't notice that it hurts, we might think that it's helping us. You know, oh, it's keeping me from failing further. Like, the more I judge myself, the more I sort of stay on the straight and narrow or something. Some bad message we inherited from some judgmental patriarchs somewhere. So notice, feel the pain, disidentify. And that's a practice, so you might take that practice on. But that's a start. It's it's labor for sure, right? Like so many of us suffer from that voice, like a lot. So it's good. It's a good thing to try to get some leverage on. Right? I'll speak more about judging in the future because we always do come back to it, especially about the distinction between judging and discernment. So that's just a teaser for the next episode of the soap opera in which Mary gets the inheritance. And then loses it again. Any final comments, observations before we close tonight? Andy, please do. Speak a little for the folks up there.
So I lost a friend over the weekend, and an interesting and very sweet and unexpected kind of karmic chain that I noticed is that he's actually the reason I'm here. Mm. And one day, randomly, he just, I suppose, started talking to Lauren at a cafe. I met Lauren a few years later, told her I was interested in meditating. She said, oh, tonight I'm going to this thing. Mm. What is this?
What's his name?
Ben.
Mm. May he be safe. Yeah. Mm. Thanks. I'm sorry. Mm. So, thanks for being here, for your kind presence. So we're here each week at this time. If this class lands on top, this class doesn't land on top of Christmas and New Year's, so we're good for now. And we offer this group fully on donation in the beautiful practice of gift economy. Your gift is both an opportunity to practice letting go in a straightforward way. Offering some of your resources, your energy, well-earned, for others to be able to practice and to maintain a gathering like this as a small resistance at the edge of capitalism. So thank you for your generosity. It's needed and well-received. Your donations are split in half between the studio and myself. They can go in the basket over there on the shelf. Please take good care of yourselves and each other, all your loved ones. Sign outside a coffee shop this morning said, hug your friends now. Mm-hmm. So, blessings. See you soon.